Today I want to talk about rehabilitating self-esteem. There's a lot of talk about self-esteem and how it's damaged and so on, but I want to talk about the rehabilitation of self-esteem. You already recognize that we use a lot of other people's information to create the image that we have of ourselves. You know, if they like us, we like them, and we tend to like ourselves. If they don't like us, we tend not to like them, and we tend not to like ourselves. So you can think, so what are the main variables that might affect us, whether those people like us or not? I think number one is the factor is whether they like themselves. If they like themselves, it is more likely that they're going to like us. And if they don't like themselves, they don't really have, if you think, liking to offer. They're not likely to like us. The second point is how our presence in their lives affects their self-interest. Those are two big factors, whether they like themselves and whether we impact their self-interest. So you think, it seems that people who like themselves appear to have more liking to share, almost like it's a quantity or a commodity, right? Liking as a thing is plentiful, so they don't mind freely sharing it because they got plenty of it at home and they recognize it's fun to receive it, it's fun to share it. But people who don't like themselves are more practiced at not liking. Not liking is, think of it, a fear-based self-protective strategy, and it's designed to prevent us from being hurt by somebody else not liking us. So we're trying to seal ourselves off from that. The second variable is how we affect somebody else's self-interest. Human nature appears to be acquisitive. That is, we want to get things. We want to acquire things. And if we perceive a threat to our ability to acquire what we want and to keep what we have, then we're not going to like that interfering person. We're going to see that other person as a threat, as a potential stealer of things that are very important to our self-esteem, our identity, our lives. Imagine a newborn baby as being a rectangular block of, say, soft, malleable clay, right? You've seen those little blocks of clay that we would have played with as children. Just imagine there's a good size block like that. People are going to come to that block of clay, over to that soft and malleable baby, and are going to give impulses of energy to it, right? You can imagine this all of a sudden, that every input is equivalent to a finger gently or roughly pushing on that soft clay. That push leaves an impression. It's easy to think of an adult's pushing on the newborn with comments about how beautiful the baby is, how it looks just like one parent or another or a grandparent or something, how pretty the fingertips are, how fully formed and amazing the fingerprints and the fingernails are, what lovely hair the baby has, what a great smile, what a beautiful face, how alert that baby is, and on and on and on. Newborn babies are miracles in creation. And it would be nice if all the inputs, all the pushes to a newborn baby were validating, respectful, empowering, loving, kind. But they're not. Not everyone in the family sees a newborn as a miracle. Some see that baby as a threat to their position in the family. Right? Loss of status is a common experience when a newborn is added to a family. Even a father or a mother can notice that their status just changed as a result of this addition. Other siblings who already exist in the family can see their status change because a newborn now is in center stage getting all the attention. It's very easy for that newborn to be seen not only as a usurper, this is to other people who now are pushed out of the limelight, but can be perceived as a burden. An added child can be an added responsibility to one or more people in that family. And, you know, that's a fact of life. This baby is going to require a lot of care. Somebody, or in the family or outside, somebody is going to have to handle this extra work. You can see that this extra work is, could be a direct reduction of freedom for the caretakers. Well, we want to go. Oh, we can't. We have because of the baby. We got to stay home because of the baby. We can't do it because of the baby. Those are standard kind of conversations that occur, and it's part of the reality of having a baby. So if we go back to that image of the clay block that is being pushed from all different directions, it's really obvious that those pushes are actually more descriptive of the person doing the pushing than it is of the baby. If a person pushes lovingly, that's an expression of the loving nature of that person at that moment. And if the push is rough or unkind or hurtful, we could say that it really is a description of the person doing the pushing. The awareness levels of other people are going to dictate how they relate to or push the newborn baby. They see that baby as a threat, they're going to do what human beings do. And if they see that as a miracle, they're going to do what humans do. So it is the awareness level that dictates that menu of options that are going to be available to each one of these pushers, each one of these people that can interact with the newborn baby. As the newborn, we start to accumulate vibrational meanings that are being transmitted to us. We learn, for better or worse, to translate "you are," put "you are" in quotes, "you are" messages into "I am." When somebody says to us as a small child, "you are dot dot dot," we will translate that to "I am" messages. And that's how our identity starts to get formed with each one of those inputs. At an early age, we don't really have the sense that we could filter out those things and recognize that, wait a minute, that person's upset, they're malfunctioning, they're drinking, they're sad, they're this, they're angry. And so their pushes, their inputs to me are not really them. If we could get that as children, we would be so much healthier and happier in life, so much more successful. If we could attribute the pushes to the pusher instead of to us, this means this about me, that means I am this way, we would be so much better off. One of the other ways that we define who we are, we start to build our self-esteem, we start to create our identity, is to start comparing ourselves to other things. It's risky. That's a risky process of defining ourselves, because there is a tendency in comparisons to consider ourselves to be more or less instead of considering ourselves to be unique. And because we start to recognize more or less, we're smaller, more powerful, cuter, not as cute, not as strong, not as able, more charming, less charming. We start to do all of this stuff, and we use those conclusions about ourselves and other people as building blocks in our identity, in our self-esteem. And so our self-esteem in that situation, in a comparative situation, really requires somebody else and their energy and their presence and their structure in order for us to sustain whatever self-esteem we have built, either if it's a wonderful sense of self-esteem or it is a not wonderful sense. We will use other people to hold those beliefs that we have about us in place. We will associate, we will use them to keep this level of self-esteem that we have normalized, whether it's completely accurate or completely inaccurate, which is more likely to be the case, we will use them for the purposes of sustaining that. If you were a Star Trek fan, you're going to understand the next reference to self-esteem. In that TV series, there was mention of a technology used by a competitive race of people called the Klingons. And that technology was called a cloaking device. The cloaking device was a technology that made the spaceship of the Klingons invisible to people and to the technologies that were available to the people on the other main craft in that series, the Starship Enterprise. So this cloaking device made the Klingons and their ship invisible to perception. Self-esteem is like a cloaking device for human beings, except it's not primarily used to make us invisible on a physical level. It is a cloaking device that does two things. One, it creates an outer force field of appearances that we and others can refer to when they and we talk about ourselves. Oh, this is me. This is me. Oh, and that outer force field that you've created, that you've put into place, that's you. And we go around acting as if that's true. That cloaking device that we use is like it supports an outer structure, a facade that we imagine to some degree to be us. The second thing it does as a cloaking device and how this relates is it forms this outer shell that protects us, and yes, it does hide the soft inner areas of our individuality from other people, the parts that we think are vulnerable. This shell, this protects our and hides our vulnerability, and it seeks to keep the inner secrets that we have, you know, the things we've thought, the things we've felt, the words we've said, the actions that we've taken. We want to keep them private, so we want to cloak them so nobody can discover that, because we fear that if somebody knew our humanness, if they knew what we thought and felt, said and did, wow, they would instantly disconnect from us. We would lose our connection to other people. We would lose them as sources of energy and nurturing, and we wouldn't have them to use in order to hold our self-esteem in place. The thickness of this facade, this shell, this cloaking of our self-esteem is based on, I think, our misunderstanding of how to be safe, and it's also based upon our level of awareness. Level of awareness to me is so important in so many different areas, because our awareness is what allows things to be available for us to make choices about. It's as if our awareness will either allow things to be on our menu of options to think, feel, say, or do, or they're not there. They are invisible to us. We just can't see them. And we use this all the time as a description, at least I do. You know, a caveman or a cavewoman is basically a guy, fight, flight. I take what I want. I hit it with a club. How many more options do I need? Well, certainly in today's world, you want more options than just those three. Fighting, running away, or hitting things with clubs and using power to get what you want. Better to be able to have higher vibration awarenesses. And if we misbelieve that we are alone, we have, you know, right? I'm all by myself. I'm just this one single unit of whatever, a body or a mind, and I'm not connected to anything else. And it's very easy to misunderstand and then believe that a thick exterior is best. I want it. That's being hard and cruel and single-minded in the pursuit of those things that my ego tells me I gotta have in order to be happy, successful, powerful, influential, rich, and so on. If we buy into that stuff, if we have all those misbeliefs, our self-esteem is basically going to be like the hardest shells that you could find on a plant or an animal. Think of a coconut. That really thick covering that protects a very, very hard shell that protects the inner contents. Or you could think of a lobster that has a very hard shell and huge weapons in its claws. You go, thick, hard shells and low awareness. There's got to be a better way. As I said earlier, we use inputs from other people and ourselves. You know, we're constantly talking to ourselves, and we're using these kind of constructive commands. I am, you are, he, she, it is, we are, they are. Those things are not reports. Those are commands. And when we deliver them about anybody or anything, it's as if we're talking to ourselves. Because ultimately, we're all connected. And it seems as though the subconscious mind doesn't know that when we're criticizing somebody over there, that we're actually only trying to criticize that person over there. And we're not really talking to ourselves. The subconscious mind says, oh, yes, you are. Yes, you are. You're talking to us. So if you criticize them, you're criticizing us. And so that boomerang effect is instantaneous. And we already understand this idea of laws of cause and effect. We reap what we sow. Sometimes that sowing and reaping are separated by nanoseconds in time. Sometimes it's a much longer period that separates them. I got this image in my mind. I'm going to see if I can describe it effectively. You would have seen some version of this with Gulliver's Travels, but I'm imagining in a city, for instance, where there's a construction site where ladders and scaffolding around the object being built. If you could just see multiple layers of scaffolding going up alongside of this building or this structure. Better to use something like the Statue of Liberty because it's more human-like in terms of its shape as compared to, say, just an office building. So you could just imagine this thing, little by little, is having materials delivered to each level of the scaffolding as necessary, and then those materials are being put into place. Once they're positioned, they're now added to the structure. Here's the important point about that. Neither the people delivering the materials to the site where our identity was being built, nor us, had any understanding of what we were doing or its long-term effects on us. Do you think for a moment that our parents and grandparents and our friends and so on would have done what they did, would have said what they said, would have delivered these inputs to us, would have made these pushes of energy into our sense of self if they had any idea how they were going to damage us and set in motion their own harvest? I don't think so. I don't think so. They would have known better. They didn't know, and neither did we. I think it's funny, in an odd sort of way, not in a humorous sort of way, that we don't know where things come from. If we conducted a survey and asked questions like these five, where does food come from? Where does health come from? Where does happiness come from? Where does wealth come from? Where does love come from? We'd get an interesting assortment of right answers. If we asked a child that first question, where does food come from? The right answers could be from the refrigerator or the pantry. And maybe if the child were more aware and had traveled a little bit, they might say, the grocery store is where food comes from. Each of these answers is right. And maybe, for ordinary questions and ordinary situations, those are sufficient answers. Maybe we don't need to go any deeper than that. Maybe that's adequate. If we watched a baby being nursed, we may be in a position where food comes from the mother. That too would be right. But the trouble with these answers is that they train us to look only at the surface level of our supply. We look at the material as thinking that is where it comes from. And by that training to look at physical things as a source of physical things, we mislead ourselves. By thinking people are the source of what we want, of our food, of our health, of our happiness, of our love, we misalign ourselves and start off in the wrong directions. And you can understand that this is the beginning of a tremendous amount of control issues. Well, if it comes from them, I think it's in my best interest to try to control them in order to be able to milk them like cows whenever I want. Human beings are not that open to being milked like cows once they get a little bit of awareness. If we think of our self-esteem as being constructed by the energies that we extract or take or manipulate or are given by other people and material objects, we're going to be hollow. If we think of our self-esteem as an electrified field, and it, you know, everything is energy, everything is electromagnetic, so that is not a stretch of the imagination. There is an electrified field. We call it biofield or aura, call a lot of different things, but it exists. And if we think of our self-esteem as that electrified field that we label as us, that's me, what do we plug into in order to sustain that field? Do we plug into concepts and things like money? Is it our work that empowers us? Is it our body's appearance that draws energy from other people? Ooh, look, nice body. Ooh, nice this, nice that. Our clothing? Is it our material possessions? Ooh, nice house. And so we're drawing energy to us by using these strategies. Is it the food or beverages that we consume? Is it the pharmaceutical drugs that we ingest? Is that what empowers this total field to include our bodies? Is it the brand of cigarettes we smoke? The beer we drink? Are you starting to see a pattern? The pattern that the inputs provided by others are largely determined by their, not our, by their self-interest and their level of awareness. The next time you watch television, watch the advertising with this idea in mind. Watch it through this kind of filter of inquiry. How are the advertisers trying to make their products important to my sense of myself? How are they positioning their products to do that? How are they trying to get me to buy into needing their products in order to build or to sustain a certain identity or a certain level of self-esteem? If I have their products, will I be more? Is that what they're trying to tell me? Yes. If I buy their products, will I not be harmed? Will I not die the way other people are going to die? Is that what they're telling me? Watch advertising and see how that plays out for you. Dreams can be informative. Besides the occasional, oh my God, I went to elementary school and I forgot to put my pants on. Over my course of my life, I've had two main dream patterns that I talk about and I'm going to talk about now. The first dream was actually a nightmare in which monsters were trying to get me. Fortunately, I called upon Jesus for help and he showed up. The monsters retreated. I slept well. The next several nights had that same pattern, except I called on Jesus earlier and earlier in the sequence. On the fourth night, I called on Jesus before I even went to sleep. Guess what? No monsters showed up, and I slept like a little baby boy that I was, with not a care in the world. So what's the point? In order to sustain myself and my self-esteem and my safety, my individuality, I didn't ask for a prescription drug. I didn't need something to dull my awareness. I was fortunate enough, somehow, I'm not certain how that occurred, to go to a higher source of safety and protection. That's where I went. I didn't go to a substitute. I went to a source that I could relate to. Much later, an inquiring person would have ultimately arrived at the answer to the questions that I asked before, right? About where does food come from, health, happiness, wealth, love? And where they come from would be, they come from God, or other ways that we label that creative power. Divine consciousness is the one I like, spirit, or whatever it is, whatever power or whatever intelligence that you think created worlds, that's where those vibrations come from. It's in our human nature to sell substitutes on a lower level, and if we grow our awareness, we can use our human nature and see stepping stones to a higher level, so we can increase our awareness and keep reaching to a different source for our happiness. Not the martini, not the cigarettes, not the material objects, but to a more refined state, to the unseen. The second major dream that I have had over the many years was about two robed priests battling for supremacy by using thought forms as their surrogates. They would create some images with their thoughts, and those images would then battle. And this is the setting, if you can imagine this. There was a huge outdoor amphitheater, kind of like the Roman Colosseum from centuries and centuries ago, but the location has always felt to me, even though as a little child I had no understanding of what Egypt was, but I would say it felt like Egyptian priests having this battle. So one priest is dressed in a white robe and the other is in a black robe, and they're in the stands, if you would, the bleachers on the other side of the arena. One on one side and on the far side was the other priest. And they're creating these thought forms that are like flying dragons that are flying in the air above the arena floor, battling one another, trying to hurt one another, trying to gain supremacy and domination over the other. As the black priest's creation in my dream is starting to overwhelm the white priest's dragon, and that's who I was, the white priest, I start to get angry. And as I get angrier and angrier, I recognize that my dragon is getting weaker and weaker. My thought form is getting weaker until I suddenly realize that I have fallen into a trap. Lower vibrations like anger don't actually empower us, even though it can give us that illusion temporarily. They actually weaken us. And so when I recognize as I'm getting angrier, I'm weakening my thought form, I immediately relax, go back into directing the highest vibration energy I can into my thought form, love and confidence, appreciation, and it becomes more and more powerful. It wasn't until years later, and I'm talking in the last 5 years or so, that I realized that this dream, as in life, I was both the white-robed priest and the black robe priest. They were not two different people. There was not me, the good guy, and somebody else, the bad guy. I was both guys. The difference, though, is that the awareness of what really sustains us, what our self-esteem is really powered by, what our true identity is really based upon, is this higher vibration connection. It is not about using force to battle other people. It's not about using lower vibrations to battle people. It is about aligning ourselves with the highest vibrations. And much like the little boy learned and the white priest learned, I think we can all learn it. There's an unseen power, call it what you will, that supplies energies that we need and want. And we can access that source anytime and every time we want to, just by reaching out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and asking for enlightenment. We needn't think we're all alone, disconnected, and go into fear of not enoughness. We can actually connect to the source of all that is, because it is part of us. We are part of it. We are an extension of the thing, the power, the consciousness that created us. And we've not been jettisoned. We've not been discarded. We're not lost. We can reconnect. All we have to do is make a decision to do that and recognize that our self, S-E-L-F, is connected to the divine self. And this is why we reach out and thought and feeling and ask for enlightenment. And in doing so, we're going to be connected, we're going to be empowered, and we're going to recognize that with the source of all of this as our resource, there's no reason for us to go into fear. There's no reason for us to battle other people by using lower vibrations. And there's no reason for them to be using lower vibrations battling other people and us. Once we rise above that, we would have rehabilitated our self-esteem. I'm going to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 in the book Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.